Hey listeners, my fabulous colleagues Amy Bernstein and Amy Gallo are back with a new season of Women at Work. You know, it's your guide to whatever you're facing at work, from anxiety to Gen AI. Listen to new episodes of Women at Work every Monday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the HBR IdeaCast from Harvard Business Review. I'm Sarah Green Carmichael. Today, I'm talking with Joseph Badaracco, professor at Harvard Business School and author of the new book, Managing in the Gray. Joe, thank you so much for coming in.
Great to be here, Sarah.
So when you talk about managing in the gray and managing gray area decisions, what do you mean by that? Is this sort of a lesser of two evils type choice, or, you know, a situation where the answer is not clear? Or is the question more, you know, is there a sort of obvious right choice, but it's more about, do you have the fortitude to take that path?
Good question. It's basically a situation where the problem or the issues or whatever they are in front of you are sort of profoundly unclear. So they may look like lesser of two evils, but sometimes you're not sure what to count as evil. In other words, there's always uncertainty in management decisions, of course. But here, a lot of basic facts are just missing, and you can't get a hold of them. And sometimes you don't know how to frame the problem either. You know, if you can frame a problem, say it's a marketing problem or something, you put it in a box and you often know how to deal with it. And then the other sign is that people you work with look at the same situation and they disagree about what ought to be done. So it's hard to be really precise about what a gray area is, but most people know what I'm talking about. They've been in them.
Yes, yes. Well, and you have a great line in the book that I think helps sort of speak to the type of problem and the general approach, which is when you face a gray area problem at work, you should work through it as a manager and resolve it as a human being. I really liked that line. How did you sort of distill it down to that sentence?
Well, my unconscious mind gets credit for that. I literally remember where I was in a room in our home when that occurred to me. And my wife was nearby and she'd read some of what I'd written. And I tried that out on her, and she said, I really like that. So I went and wrote it down. But the reason I've used it is that it captures two important elements of facing gray area situations. First, you have to approach them as a manager. And this means you work with other people. You get the best information you can. Use big data if you've got that. Use analytics if you've got that. Get expert advice. Look at options with other people. Work the process. Be a good manager. And sometimes you get an answer. It'll be pretty clear, very clear what you ought to do. But if it isn't and it's gray, then you've got to make the decision. And you can't rely on analytics or frameworks. You make that judgment call as who you are. And then you live with it afterwards. As a manager, you're held accountable. And as a human being, you prefer to look back and say, I got more of them right than wrong.
Yeah. Well, so even though you sort of say you can't rely on a framework, your book does present something of a framework. It's a series of five timeless questions that are sort of drawn from, you know, Western philosophical traditions and, you know, have resonances in Eastern traditions that will help managers kind of work through these situations. I'd like to run through some of those questions.
Sure.
Can.
Sure.
So the first one is very much clearly in the zone of manager. What are the net consequences? I thought that the example you had in this chapter of Malden Mills was really interesting, because I think that's a story some people may remember, some people may not be familiar with it. But maybe you just start here by sort of telling the story, and then we can sort of see how the net consequences played out.
Sure. Well, Malden Mills was basically the last big New England textile manufacturer. They make Polartec, which a lot of people will know about. They had a terrible fire about 20 years ago. It destroyed most of the operation. The owner, son of the founder, Aaron Feuerstein, decided apparently on the spot, almost immediately after the fire, that he would use the insurance money to rebuild everything with the latest technology. And he did this partly because he had a real commitment to his workers and the communities they worked in. It turned out, however, in hindsight, which is, of course, 2020, that he really should have stepped back, been more analytical, more objective, looked at a range of options and a range of future scenarios. And he might have seen what turned out to be the case, really tough times ahead. If you're a textile manufacturer in America or New England, And he might have had to close down some parts of the operation, which would have been painful given his commitments to workers and communities. But he might have been able to save the rest with some combination of rethinking strategy and restructuring the business. He didn't take that, at least as I interpret things from press accounts, he didn't take that objective view and didn't really look at the net-net consequences. What I say in the book is that what you ought to do is a simple decision tree. Here's different scenarios. Here's what we'll do. Here's the likelihood that these scenarios will occur. And you test your plan against these possible futures.
Yeah.
That didn't seem to happen.
Yeah, it seems, you know, in the book, you really hammer home on this idea of thinking broadly and deeply and coming up with more options in those kinds of situations, which you can see how in the Maldonville story, you know, he clearly thought he was doing the right thing. It just, the long-term net-net right thing may have been something else.
Well, here's where we come back to the mantra, work through these problems as a manager. And I think it's important to be aware of your initial intuitions. You know, you might be onto something. They might be biased or incomplete. Be aware of them and then put them to the side and then work with other people on what I just described, the scenarios, the risks, what you're likely to do. Work through that as objectively as you can. I use the example in the book of why computers often beat the best human chess players. Computers look analytically at all the possibilities, and we human beings have our preferences from the beginning. And those, you've got to try to get beyond them.
Yeah. Well, and then I think one way that you sort of encourage people to do that is with the second question, which is, what are my core obligations?
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about, you know, maybe sticking with the Maldonville story. How might that have played out?
Well, the problem with talking about core duties or core obligations is that most people, if they stop and think, will realize they've got lots of them. And if you're a manager like Feuerstein was, you've got them to shareholders, banks, employees. You can go down the list. This was a family company. He felt some obligation to his, the legacy of his family and so forth. You know, if you're a parent, if you're a police officer, there's duties that come with the job. So how do you figure out what's core? What goes to the front of the line? Which duties are in effect? You're juggling a lot of balls, and there's a couple of them that are red balls that you just don't want to drop. What I propose in the book is that you stop and use what has been called for centuries your moral imagination and try to put yourself in the shoes of the people who will be affected by the decision, especially the most vulnerable people in those situations, and ask yourself, what would you want to happen? What sort of regard would you want paid to you? What would you really care about? I quote Hillel the Elder, the ancient Hebrew philosopher who said, was his version of the golden rule, not do unto others, but he said, ask what would be hateful if you were in a particular situation. And that way you may get a clearer sense of some boundaries on things you really don't want to do. And I think in the case of Malden Mills, again, reading into the story with hindsight, the Feuerstein may have realized that he didn't want to be anywhere close to a situation where almost everybody would get laid off and the business would go bankrupt as it did. And I think if he saw that as a central core obligation, he might have looked at some other options. History might be somewhat different.
Yeah. I mean, what is interesting to me is that we have talked about two of the five questions. We haven't even gotten yet to practicalities.
Yeah.
But that's the third question.
It's
sort of what will work in the real world. And I just found it so interesting that this came in the middle. Like, it's not what comes at the end. It's not where you start. Why did you put this question of what will work in the real world in the middle of this process?
Well, it sort of serves as a balancing mechanism or even a corrective to the first two questions, which have kind of an idealistic element to them. We want to do the best we can for everybody affected net-net. I want to be faithful to the core obligations in this situation. That's lovely. The third question is actually Machiavelli's question, and the emphasis is what will work in the world as it is. And that's a world where there could be surprises, good and bad. There's lots of self-interest, and there's just a lot of dumb, random stuff that happens. And you need to be resilient, and you need a plan that's resilient in a world like that. So it comes in the middle, lest we veer off too strongly in an unrealistic or idealistic direction. You said there is kind of a loose framework, and there is.
Mm.
But the questions aren't supposed to be used as kind of an algorithm. You use them all together, they balance and correct each other. And that's why this one is where it is.
Mm, that makes sense. The last couple of questions are sort of back to more of a philosophical side, I would say. This is where you get to being resolving it as a human, like we said at the beginning. Who are we? And then finally, what can I live with?
Yeah. Well, who are we is partly philosophical, but it's also saying, look, you're not an isolated individual and you make these decisions if you're a manager. You're working with other people. Typically in a business, there are certain values, there's commitments. I distinguish between sort of fundamental or core commitments and all the standard stuff you see on the mission, on the wall, and the mission statements. And the core ones are the ones that people really struggle to get right. When push comes to shove, these are the things that really define who the people are in an organization. There's often stories that circulate and tell you what those are. So you've got to look for a way out of a gray area that seems to be consistent with those fundamental values in the organization. You can sort of imagine these first four questions as a funnel.
Mm.
And you may reject some things because they don't work on the net-net basis. Some may not meet core obligations. Some may not work. Some may be outside the realm of your organization's values. And that's great because you've narrowed your options. And sometimes you may have an answer at this point. But if it's really gray, then you've got to decide, that's the last question. What can I live with? And there I give some suggestions for how to step back. Rely on your intuition, but make sure your intuition is tempered and guided and shaped by the considerations in these other questions. And then the funny thing, Sarah, is that what's the right answer to a gray area problem? It's what you decide it is.
Mm.
You don't find the answer. You create it, if you're a manager, by making a decision. You say, here's what we're going to do. This is why. This is what I'll do. This is what you'll do. This is how we'll benchmark. And that's how these things are ultimately resolved, by somebody's judgment. But it's tempered judgment, tempered intuition, after they've worked through it first as a manager and then ask these fundamental questions that have been around forever. But at the end of the day, it's somebody's call. They live with it as a professional, as an employee, and as a person.
What if it's not your call? Like, what if you are part of a team of senior leaders and ultimately the CEO or you know, the head of the organization is going to make the call, and yet you feel strongly that that person is going to make the wrong call? You know, what are your options in that situation? If you sort of do this for yourself, realize the answer you'd come to, and it's very different than the one your boss is choosing.
Two things. First, you would hope that there would be meetings held by the person who's going to make the decision where people can honestly put their concerns on the table. And the book gives some guidance for how to structure meetings in that direction. So you hope you've had a chance to express your convictions honestly, and you hope they've been heard. Now, if you think the person making the decision is really headed in the wrong direction, you may want to just try to cross paths with them at the water cooler, knock on their door, send them an email and say, look, could I have 5 minutes? After that, I think you've done all you can, unless you think they're doing something that is highly unethical, illegal, going to put them on 60 minutes. Then you got another set of consideration. But if it's just a gray area and it's not your call, all you can do is give your best guidance.
Mm. You know, you mentioned 60 minutes, and I think for a lot of people, they do sometimes reduce or collapse this whole process into a sort of, well, how would we feel if this ended up on 60 minutes, or what would it look like on the front page of the New York Times? What is your reaction when people use that kind of rule of thumb?
You know, I think that's a good test. I think it picks up on all the net-net consequences because we live in this world where media is ubiquitous. I think it certainly points towards what's practical. It sort of raises in the background the question of, let's say you were on 60 Minutes and the 60 Minutes stars was interrogating you and they've only got this little box showing, they don't even show your forehead and the bright lights are on. What would you say to explain why we did it and why I did it? So I think it's a good test. That said, there's an old saying that today's newspaper wraps tomorrow's fish. And the world moves on. So at the end of the day, you've got to do something that will work for you and your organization and not something that is going to work well in the paper or on the internet tomorrow. It's a very important consideration, but it shouldn't be decisive.
Yeah. Well, then the Malden Mill story did play very well in the media at the time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. He was a hero. He was invited to one of President Clinton's State of the Union addresses. He got a lot of honorary degrees. I think in terms of his motives, his aspirations, he deserved them. But I think he could have been more pragmatic. I think he could have answered a couple of the questions a little differently with more time, more patience, and maybe some better conversations and meetings with people in the firm.
Yeah, I wonder if there is a situation where you go through this process, you do your best, you make the wrong call. Is there a way to sort of own up to that or to then make a different call? You know, obviously leaders have to be decisive. You have to live with your decisions. But what would your advice be to someone who's said, I made this decision, I think it was the wrong call. How do I explain that to people? What would you tell that person?
Well, first, you've got to make sure you've made the wrong call. So you have to look at, you've got to approach these things again as a manager. You got to get the best data. Your judgment may tell you, gee, I've made the wrong call. The next question is, can we just modify the path we're on? Now, in the old days, if you built a big factory and put the wrong equipment in there, you were stuck for a while. It was like a big cannonball attached to your leg by a chain, okay? Nowadays, with flexible supply chains, there's a lot more fluidity in organizations, okay? So often you can say we need to recalibrate. This is what lots of entrepreneurial firms
pivoting,
do. They call,
right?
call it pivoting.
Yeah.
And they've got some assets, they've got some opportunities, they rethink and recast. That's great. But if you've just made a mistake, it's a bad mistake, you can't fix it, I think the best thing to do is to fess up to it. First of all, people in the organization will, in most cases, they'll know you made a mistake. Your boss may well know you made a mistake. Everybody makes mistakes. You put it on the table, try to learn from it, do the best you can. Now, it's easy to sit here and distinguish, as I'm about to, between two types of mistakes, type A and type B. Type B, you can recover from and learn from. Type A are much more serious, cataclysmic, you don't recover. I don't know what kind of insurance policy you have against those, except what I've described before. The best process as a manager, the best process as a human being, make a decision and cross your fingers, hope it works, and do everything you can to make it work, but we only control so much.
Well, Joe, this has been really helpful and reassuring in many ways.
Good. You. Glad to hear that.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to us.
You're welcome, Sarah. Nice talking with you.
That was Joe Badaracco. The book is Managing in the Gray. For more, visit hbr.org. And as always, you can send us feedback at twitter.com/HarvardBiz or facebook.com/HBR. Thanks.